Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. I'm Carol Levine, and I will be hosting the show tonight. We do have, a wonderful guest on tonight, and she is from PA. She is a forensic nurse, and she'll be telling us all about that. She's also a survivor. Her name is, I believe it's Michelle Frey, or Fry. I don't quite know how she pronounces that, F-R-E-Y. And a lot of times she has to go into court and help testify in cases where people have been abused and children. And she's really got quite a bio here. And I'm delighted to have her on this show tonight. In her family, there was a lot of sexual abuse, like I said before, a lot of incest, and a lot of things that we at NASCA know all too much about. So she's going to be a wonderful person to have on tonight. We also have Jo Kolk here. She is from Oregon, and she's going to be helping me run the show because I have still no computer. Hey, I'm waiting, but I know how to run these shows, so I don't need the computer, especially if I have someone like Jo to back me. Thank you so much, Jo, for being here. You are an angel. Now, I'm going to read the mission statement, and then I will get to our guests, and we'll go from there. We have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent and physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do two different ways. Number one is educating the public, very important, especially related to getting the society over the taboo of discussing child abuse and sexual child abuse in particular. All right. And that's presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic. It is a worldwide problem. We know this. All right, number two is offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And boy, do I usually have a lot to say about that. Okay. So let me now go to our guest who's sitting there waiting for us. And I'm going to ask you first of all how you pronounce your last name. Is it Frey or is it Fry? How do you pronounce that, Michelle?
It's Fry.
Fry, okay. I wasn't sure. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No problem.
So you're from Pennsylvania. I'm from New Jersey, so we're not far away. And you are a forensic nurse. But before we get into what you're doing today, what we ask our guests to do is to tell us about where they came from, okay? What type of life you had and how you became then a nurse, and we'll get into that at the end. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to say I'm, like, super nervous, so I apologize.
Let me say something to you, okay, which is the truth, okay? First of all, I make you louder. Hold on. Okay, that's going to be better. you were survivors, okay? And then we're speaking to the public, yes. But in the public, we have survivors, many survivors who listen. Sometimes they listen while the show is going on. Sometimes they call in later on. Sometimes they listen to the archives. This is a very laid-back show. I want you to try and relax because we're here to support you every step of the way. And what we do is many times we ask for our guests to go chronologically. You know, first of all, tell us what type of family you came from, and then talk about, you know, your earliest things that you remember, like when your abuse started. And remember, there isn't anything you can say that can shock us because, unfortunately, well, we've been through it all, okay?
Yeah.
So we're here to educate those people, you know, that don't know too much about child abuse and, who haven't, you know, been through what we've been through. This is one way that NASCA works to bring forth awareness, you know, to society. So just, you know, try to relax a little bit. Have a glass of something. I don't care what it is, okay? and we'll get started when you're ready.
Okay. So my name is Michelle. I'm from York, Pennsylvania, or Spring Grove, like the town or whatever. My family gets kind of complicated. My dad was 16 when he had me, and my mom was 18. Like, she just turned 18. They were high school sweethearts. Very toxic relationship. One of those relationships where by themselves, like, they're good people, but when they get together, you know, it hurts themselves and everybody, like, around them. So they were very young when they had me. I know the relationship wasn't great. My first memories, I mean, I heard rumors while my mom was pregnant and that, but my first memory of my mom and my dad was in a living room. I know my mom was anxious looking out the window. My dad, he was addicted to a lot of drugs and alcohol, came home under the influence of something. All I know is that they were yelling, screaming, and my dad pinned my mom up to a wall and held a knife up to her throat. Of course, my mom was screaming, "Don't." You know, I'm screaming, crying, because I had to have been, like, four. Like, I was really young. Actually, my mom's really surprised that I even remember that. You know, I'm screaming, crying, and then I remember my dad looking at me, telling me to shut up or else he's going to kill her and then kill me next. That's kind of, like, my first memory. Things were, you know, toxic. I do have a brother that was put up for adoption during that time. My mom was trying to be a single mom, make things work, you know, addiction. Needless to say, like, they separated, got apart. My mom met somebody else. She started, you know, going to church. She met somebody else. And me and that person just never got along. There was a lot of control and power issues there. He came into, like, an already made family, wanted to kind of erase the fact that, like, I ever – had a dad, you know. He told my mom that the only way he would marry her is if he legally adopted me, because he didn't want my dad in the picture at all. Like, my dad was trying to see me, but he wanted, so they threatened him, you know, and my dad didn't have a lot of money. that, you know, they're going to make him pay, they're going to make his life miserable, which is, they've told me this, so it's not me reading into anything, because that was something that they always then used against me, that my dad wasn't even willing to, like, step up and pay for me, and I don't know. But either way, he adopted me. And then because of that fact, he always made it seem like I owed him because he paid money for me and it was expensive and he didn't have to do that. And it all boiled down to really the fact that, like, I wouldn't call him. He wanted me to call him dad so bad and not talk about my dad or nothing. And it would just cause chaos.
Right.
I was going to say, lots of psychological abuse. I know when I was younger, he used to, things would get so heated, he would take wooden paddles, and literally break them. Like, he would make me get undressed and literally break them over my butt and, like, the back of my thighs, and went through numerous paddles. if you ask him, you know, it's because I was obviously fighting to get away. But,
right.
One of those things. It wasn't every day, you know, but I know if he had a bad day at work, or if him and my mom were fighting, whatever, I knew I was going to take the brunt of something. And right. I'm not saying I'm a perfect child, but, like, I was very, like, if I even looked the wrong way, I was called, I mean, he told me for years, well, he told my mom and me for years that I was demon-possessed and there's something wrong with me. And really, like, I go to school and my teachers love me. I go to church, my Sunday school teachers love me. Like, it wasn't that I was, like, this defiant child, but in the home, I read a lot about, like, narcissistic families, and, like, we fit that prototype 100%,
right.
And I was definitely the scapegoat of the family, so anything that could go wrong was my fault. And I think he probably saw me as a threat to get my parents back together, which is something, like, I lived in that toxic environment, so that wasn't at all what I wanted, but I think he knew my mom really loved my dad, and ironically enough, they did end up getting back together. When I was 16, I ended up getting pregnant. Well, 16, just about to turn 17, I ended up getting pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I was given the ultimatum to either get an abortion or my mom would let me see my dad again. Like, that was the – and I was all but, like, for – like, I was going to keep the baby because at that point, like, all I wanted was a family and out of that house. And that's the only thing I wanted. But when she brought up my dad, like, I missed my dad. Like, I want – you know. So that was a struggle on what to do. Well, I did end up getting the abortion. I was all but 4 months. Like, I was right at the point where, like, they another week or two, they wouldn't have done it.
Right,
Then I ended up getting the abortion. I'm 17 at this point. I ended up moving back into my dad because there was chaos with my second dad. That wasn't a healthy environment. And then within a week, my mom ended up telling my second dad that she never loved him, she was just using him, and moved in with my biological dad. So kind of like I was used as like that key, and I remember I never felt such outrage as I did at that point because I'm like for years, like I begged you to stick up for me, I begged you to have my back, I begged, you know, and I would get the runaround like if I really loved her, you know, like I'm going to move out one day, you know, he makes her happy, but he didn't treat her great either.
I would get the thing
because she, like, something would happen and she would, you know, run out tearfully, you know, things would get heated with me and him, it would get out of control, and I would confront her, like, the next day, like, why didn't you do something, why didn't you stick up for me, and, like, her response was, well, you don't know what I say to him behind closed doors, and I would get, you know, well, God wants, women are supposed to respect their husbands. It's in the Bible. And so it's like all that I was told my whole life on like why I wasn't like worth standing up for, like totally became null and void. when it came, do you know what I mean? Like, so I was like a ticket and I never disrespected my mom because my mom was, I always saw her like as my saving grace. Like, even though like a lot of stuff, now I look back and there's a lot that falls into place, makes sense. Then, like, she was really, like, the only thing, she was the only consistent person that I had, if that makes sense.
Right,
So, I never disrespected my mom. I never, you know, like, you get in fights with your parents, but, like, I never would call her names or I never lifted a finger at, you know what I mean? Like, that was my mom. I always respected that. But when that happened and she moved in with it, I'm like, I got upset because I was like, not only did you make me kill my child, that I really, like, I was buying baby stuff and everything. Like, you didn't even get me the chance to reconnect with my dad, and let alone, like, everything he told me my whole, like, so you couldn't stand up for me my whole life because of all these, like, values and morals and this is, but then once he comes in the picture, that doesn't matter, you know? And I know at one point, like, I remember him giving my second dad giving my mom the ultimatum, either I go or he goes, and I was temporarily, is the word she used, signed into, like, the system. So I was in a group home and different placement facilities for a little bit because...
Okay, let's stop there for a second, okay?
Sure.
Okay. Well, what we usually do is we go to the panel. I don't know how many people are going to be here tonight because everyone's scared. We have a pandemic out there, and, of course, in other cities and states, there's other things going on and has been for days. But I want you to know, okay, as you're speaking, okay, a lot of your story is you're not unique. None of us are unique, okay? And, like, when I say that, I mean, okay, I didn't want to call my stepfather dad. I never did. He was not American. He was from Denmark, actually. And his name, strange name, his name was Hylia. And so that's what I called him. So I understand that not wanting to call your stepfather. I mean, either you form a relationship with your stepfather or you don't, or your stepmother, whichever the case might be. And and so what you're talking about there, I could identify with so well. The beatings, and I consider that beatings that he gave you, that's corporal punishment. You know that. And that's something that none of us ever, you know, should go through. And it's a terrible thing that you had to even just go through that, because that's corporal punishment. As far as with your father popping in and out, I can understand that, because I was like floating back and forth too. I have two children, and I was floating back and forth because I really adored my first husband. Okay? He looked like a movie star. He was a biker. He had also had a Cadillac. Now that made sense, but he did. And I wanted so much for us to be like the Brady Bunch, okay? Because, you know, I came from such terrible dysfunction. And I understand how your mother at times would go, she probably still did love him very much, okay? I had terrific love feelings for my first husband. But he just didn't know how to be a father. You understand that? He didn't know how to be father. And so then I too, you know, remarried. And there was no way that my children actually really didn't take to the second man that I married at all. I mean, there was hardly any relationship there. So, you see, these things happen in families. I noticed that in your bio that also there was incest involved. Where did that come from?
Well, I didn't experience any incest, but a lot of my family members have. Actually, my dad's family is extremely dysfunctional. He died back in 2015, and he actually was 49. He died of pancreatic cancer, and he had 3 months. And I actually, like, I knew some stuff, and I did see, well, my dad's father, my grandfather, I never knew. Like, he actually left that my dad when their family when they were little, too. So I never knew him. I did know my dad's mom, my grandmother, and her husband, the stepfather. And I did know that, like, my mom and the stepdad didn't get along. Like, there was issues there. But I guess as a kid, like, you don't, you know what I mean? You just kind of go with the flow, whatever. But he was, like, a psychopath. I knew some stuff up until my dad died. But when my dad was dying and my family came back together, like, I learned so much more. And I guess I had more respect for my dad knowing everything he endured. So the stepfather would rape them, all of them. There was four of them, would, you know, rape all of them. And this is years and years and years ago. Well as my grandmother's brother, they call him Uncle Ernie or whatever, he actually raped and molested a bunch of my cousins. And my dad and his siblings. So there was a lot of going on. I know I had two cousins actually taken out of the home by Children in Youth because it was, you know, reported at every point, and they were actually put up for adoption. Like, they weren't even given the option to go back.
Right.
I know my dad had a dog that he really liked when he was little, and I guess the stepdad actually killed his dog as, like, punishment. Like, I mean, we're talking, they would break their fingers as punishment. And apparently, from what I learned, my dad and the oldest daughter actually took the blunt of that abuse, which explains a lot of my dad reactions. But I also learned during that time when my dad was dying that that was another reason why he left, because he didn't want that for me.
Right.
Like, he knew what would happen if I was around them more.
Okay, sweetheart. Let's I have Joe, and I know she's busting. She wants to ask you a question or make a comment or something. And I want you just to take a deep breath, because you're with friends, okay? You're with family. Just take a deep breath, honey, because I know you're very nervous, and you know what? You don't have to be. This is like we're on the phone talking, you know what I'm saying? You know?
Yeah.
I know this brings up a lot of emotional things with you. And that's what it does, you know. But you're doing a fine job, and you have a lot to speak about. And we have an hour and a half to do it. So just try to calm down. And I'm going to have Joe come on now, and she can ask you a couple of questions or make some comments. Okay, go ahead, Joe.
Hi. Thank you so much, Michelle, for being here. I just wanted to tell Carol as well that at one point there were four panelists. There are now two panelists who are waiting to ask a question. Darlene from Tennessee and Mary Ellen from New York. So if you wanted to start with them,
okay,
that would be fine.
Okay. And then I'll get back to you. Okay. It's hard. I don't have the screen. I don't have the screen in front of me, so I can't see. Okay. Darlene, from Tennessee. Let's go with you.
Hello. Hello. But it's very brave of you to tell your story. I have done it as well. I was nervous. As a matter of fact, I had two different chances to do that, and I did it. And now you're really my sister, and you don't have to worry about it, me being abusive to you. You won't be the scapegoat. I won't make you the scapegoat, okay? I'll just love you as a sister, all right?
Thank you.
Okay, that's good. And who else was the other one, Joe?
Mary Ellen from New York.
Mary Ellen from New York. Let's welcome to the show, and maybe you have a question or a comment. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for having me. Michelle, I want to thank you for joining us and sharing your history and where you are today. I encourage you to know it's okay to speak. And we understand your pain and where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. So
thank
it's
you.
Very, I think, to be able to share.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for that. Thank you. And Joe, was there something that you wanted to ask or a comment? Go ahead.
Okay. One of it was to relax that you're among friends, and now you hear that and you get that, that you know that we're all here for you and we're all here supporting you, and that is a very traumatic thing to go through. So I'm looking forward to hearing how you came through that and how you came to be where you are now. So thank you.
Listen, the very thought that you were buying, you know, baby clothes and everything, my guess is that you were about 4 months along. Is that what you were saying, possibly around four
months?
Yeah, a little bit
shy. It was about 3.5 months.
Uh-huh. And so that in itself would be very upsetting because, you know, you're buying baby clothes and you're thinking, you know, that you're going to have, you know, your baby. And then you were told that you couldn't do this and on it goes. So go from that point on. I know that you were devastated. You were struggling, so you certainly didn't want to have the baby, you know, have this abortion. I don't think that you did. You wanted the baby. So That's very hard. That's very hard. Go from that point on. What happened? You said that you were put in foster care for a while. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was in group homes and placements. Another thing about, though, the abortion thing is I was sexually abused and raped as well for about 2 years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told by the doctor, my mom was with me when I got the news, that there was a very strong possibility that I couldn't have kids. And, like, since then, like, I've always had so much problems with my reproductive system, the whole nine. So the fact that, like, I even got pregnant was a shock, which made the decision even harder. You know, so I think that was another thing as well that made it, I felt more betrayed because this was I always wanted a baby. She knew better than anybody there was a strong possibility I might not be able to have kids. So I lashed out. That was the only time I disrespected my mom. I didn't, not physically, you know what I mean, but I was upset. And I left, and I was on my own pretty much then ever since. I moved in with my boyfriend at the time, who would have been the father of the baby. That was a very bad, abusive relationship. So if he would have found out I had an abortion, I don't know that I would be here today. So right. then I had to, you know, try to cover that up from him, you know, as like a miscarriage. And mm-hmm. so it was just like one bad situation after another. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah.
That's painful. That's very painful. You know, it's amazing how we go from one situation, from one bad situation to another bad situation to another bad situation. And and each time you think that it's the right choice, and then it turns out not to be. This is very common amongst, you know, children who witness domestic violence, you know, who are come from backgrounds like that, and then, two, who have been sexually abused. It does something to us, and, you know, we make poor choices. We make poor choices. So what happened after you this relationship broke up?
Well, that actually broke up. It would have been like 2003, I believe, is when that finally ended. But that mm-hmm. was a really bad relationship. Like, he actually pulled a gun out on me, tried mm-hmm. to kill me. I actually had the detective pull, because the neighbors called the cops and say, like, you have an angel looking out for you. Like, because I guess there's, like, a watermark or something when a bullet's fired. So he mm-hmm. showed me. He was like, I want to show you something. And he showed me, and he said, do you know what that means? It means that it did go off, and if it wouldn't have got jammed, you might not be here. The relationship was bad. Like, he would pee on me. He wouldn't, and then wouldn't let me get into the shower because unless I would tell him that I loved him. He shut down all forms of communication. It was just a really bad, toxic relationship. But that's mm-hmm. been over and done with for a while. So.
No, that's good. That's good. But even through all of this stuff that you're telling us, and this is a pretty horrific story that you're telling. You had some horrible times here. You managed to go to school. School seemed to be a safe haven for you. Am I correct?
Yeah, but it's actually, like, it wasn't planned or anticipated. It just kind of, like, you know, like when the stars kind of align and things kind of work out the way it worked out. It kind of worked out the way it did, but it wasn't, like, I didn't have anything going for me, like, if that makes sense. Like, the opportunity mm-hmm. just kind of, like, made itself available. I took it and, by the grace of God, succeeded. Mm-hmm. But I was older when I went to college because I actually ended up dropping out of high school and got my GED.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't graduate with my nursing from college. It was May 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back later.
Well, that's fine. A lot of people do that, though. You know, you have to understand, we have to get our heads together so that we can even concentrate, you know. Because, Michelle, I don't know about you, but a lot of people, okay, a lot of people who have been abused as a child, they can't concentrate right in school because they know that when they go back home, you know, they know what they're in for. Okay, or what they're going to observe. Like, even if you were not sexually abused, let's say you were not, but you were watching domestic violence, okay,
mm-hmm.
that's considered to be child abuse too, because mm-hmm. that's something that is such a negative thing, because the people that we love, like mommy and daddy, they're supposed to nurture us, right, and be there for us and to teach us right from wrong. And look what they're doing. They're teaching us right from wrong. They're showing us violence. That's what they're showing us. And that can do something terrible to a child. It can make a child very angry. If they don't know any better, you know, they might think that that's the way it is in families. And this is just the way that it is. And they become volatile themselves, you know. It can affect a child in all different ways and all different aspects. So, what you saw, okay, as a child, mm-hmm. and, you know, not being able to bond with your stepfather, and a lot of us know what that feels like, not being able to move forward. I mean, when you were younger, though, going to school, you probably felt safer there, yes or no? You liked school?
Yes, but school had its different challenges, like, because of everything, like, I was going through when I went through.
Mm-hmm.
I never really learned how to, I guess, bond and connect with the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, and I guess with all the events and stuff, it does trigger a lot.
Sure.
But I remember being like in school in first grade, and I remember this as clear as day because I would always dread when the teacher would ask, "What did you do for the weekend?" Or what? And I mean, I did not. It wasn't every day was horrible, but I mean, that house was hell, like from my perspective. And, mm-hmm. you know, and during that time, like, I was going through the sexual abuse and stuff, so I would always dread that question. And I remember my classmates would always have, like, these responses. Like, they would do all these nice stuff, like, with their family and extended family. And so I kind of learned to, like, make their memories as mine, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
like, mm-hmm. you know, I remember, like, one time I was in a different classroom, and this girl was telling a story what she did for the weekend. And I don't know if it was later that day or the next day or whatever, but either way, the next time I was asked what I did, I just used her words because I wanted that. You know what I mean? Because nobody wanted to know, or I didn't want to say what I went through. You know what I mean? So I kind of lived through other people, but in that process, you know, kids aren't stupid either. You know, I got called a liar. I got, you know, because that's what I was doing, you know, but they didn't they were too young to understand why I had to lie.
That's copycatting.
Really what was going on.
Right, that's
yeah.
copycatting. And you see, a lot of us have to do that because if we don't have what we have or are supposed to have in our homes, okay, what we do is we copycat what we think is normal or will sound good to other people. I hated it when we went back to school after summer and we had to talk about what we did that summer because we didn't do anything that summer. What I do, go to the city pool? Everybody went to the city pool, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I would make up stories. In my essays, I would make up stories because I had to. And when it would come to my turn to tell my story, I wanted it to sound as good as the other kids' stories. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So
that's
copycatting. And a lot of people have to do that, okay? So what you're saying, excuse me, what you're saying is something that a lot of us do. So you see that you're on the right show. Yes, you are. We understand you completely.
And I was gonna say, and like my body, because of the years of that I was sexually abused and being raped, and my body developed quicker. So I went through puberty and everything faster. So my breasts before all the other girls, and they would tease me. You know, I get made fun of, and then of course the boys, like, because we're talking fourth, fifth graders. You know, they're making comments and stuff, and you know how you have little girlfriend boyfriends, you know, the girl would get jealous and get mad at me, and you mean, like, there's all these situations, and that's, I guess, why, like, I think it's huge to advocate, because I think it's all that little stuff that people don't realize that you go through, that people go through, that I think if you haven't gone through it, like, you wouldn't even realize that happened.
That's right, that's exactly right. I'm going to go to the panel and see if they want to ask you anything right now. Let's go to Darlene from Tennessee. Is there something that you wanted to ask or make a comment about or that you can identify with?
Well, you know, school was like a safe haven for me for a little while until, you know, little things like if I got a pounding from the teacher or something like that, then it switched, you know. Because one teacher was so mean, you know, he paddled the whole entire class, and I didn't think that was fair, you know. And he was our Sunday school teacher, too, and so that made it not so much of a safe haven anymore after that, you know. But school was like a safe haven for me. That, you know, I didn't have to worry about home. It's like no one can hurt me like that. That hurts me as bad as they hurt me at home. I don't have to worry about them. You know, knocking before flip or shooting at me or whatever, you know.
Right.
So, you know, like I said, you're with family here, so I can feel that you're getting a little bit less nervous now.
Yeah, I am listening up. Thank you to everyone.
Yeah. And you know, it, by the time the show is over, you'll be even more relaxed, and you'll be happy that you got this off your chest. Have you spoken about this a lot to other people, or is this the first time you've been on radio, things like that?
This is definitely the first time I've been on radio, and it's definitely the first time I've come out publicly. I mean, people know bits and pieces, and there might be one or two people I went into more detail with than others, but it's one of those things where it's not really talked about. You know, like, I know my mom has a lot of, you know, shame for what happened and stuff, so, like, if I bring it up, like, I'm kind of, and that's another thing I think people don't realize with the sexual abuse and stuff, like, even though everybody knows it's wrong, lots of times the child who's being abused kind of wears that shame, regardless if people realize it or not, because every time I think my mom, that subject comes up, like, my mom can't look at me, like, my mom can't, and she doesn't realize that, like, I understand, like, she's shameful, but that's not who I am, like, I'm not what happened to me, I'm not, you know what I mean, like, I'm not that, you know,
right.
But I think
you don't let it
when
define
you,
you
kind of wear that shame, and people don't realize that, and I think by not talking about it and not, you know, it being so uncomfortable, it kind of, you wear that shame longer, like, if that makes sense, like, it's, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You feel more like you stick out like a sore thumb. And
yeah. Well, we always have a lot of issues, you know, that we have to go through, you know, in the healing process. And it takes a long time to heal a lot of times. We have to come to terms, you know, and grips with our own feelings, what we're going through. And you know, there's just so much to deal with. But you're on your healing journey. Let's go to, I think her name was Mary Ellen from New York. I don't have this.
And then there. And then after that is William.
Okay. Go ahead, Mary Ellen.
Hi. yeah, I was thinking back about when I was younger and there was a lot of domestic abuse in our family. And everything that's going on right now is very triggering, you know. And you said something about it kind of brings up thoughts, and I think that's very real. And it's difficult when your parents are who you expect to be your saviors, and yet you don't know what to trust.
Right. So, yeah.
And then trying to move forward as an adult and figure out what's right and what are safe boundaries. It's a very difficult task.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is very, very difficult. Thank you so much for that, Mary Ellen. Let's go to William, okay? William, you're on. Say hi to Michelle.
Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, this is a very interesting story, and thanks. I see a lot of different similarities in some of these cases like you're talking about, too. And there's a lot that affects that in future relationships, too, from the past issues. And I can understand that, too, the divorce and the issues that you were talking about, that between your father and your stepfather and your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Because I face, because I'm divorced, and I face some of the same issues because of the kids and what was going on with the wife, and she remarried the other guy and things like that. So I faced a lot of those issues, too. And I'm familiar with what you're talking about, how the one doesn't want to deal with the other and the family and all that. So I'm familiar with that stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
and it's kind of like a cycle.
So, but I'm glad you're bringing out the story and the issues and things like that. And I'm sure you're going to get more confident with these people around you. Mm-hmm. And now you're in with NASCA and stuff, and you'll get to know people better, and you'll feel more comfortable, and you're dealing with getting over this issues. I see, because I know Darlene, and I know some of the issues with Darlene and stuff. So, anyways, you're doing a good job, and just keep it up.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
There you go. And Jody, is there something that you wanted to ask or make a comment about?
Yes, thank you. First of all, 646-595-2118, call in, get on the panel to talk with Michelle. Michelle, it sounded like you were pretty much alone through most of your childhood. Is that a true statement?
Yeah, I mean, I would get friends here and there, but I never had, you know, how most people have, like, best friends, and, like, everybody would always have, like, their little clique. Like, you know, I would have friends, and maybe for a couple months I might somebody, and then kind of one of those things. But, yeah, I pretty much learned, like, to stay to myself. Not that I didn't have friends, but I just, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't really
have part of the
close friends that people develop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the that's unfortunately part of the result of the trauma. So I look forward to hearing more, especially how you're going to come through this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah. Yeah, I don't have a computer right now, so Joe has to let me know when people are coming on. Mine's in Staples. Staples, can you hear me? I need my computer. but anyway, a lot of times when we have a household like that and we come from a household like that, we don't want people coming over to our house, because we don't know how they're going to behave, you know, for one thing. And then a lot of times the parents say, no, you can't, you know, they'll turn it around, they'll the other side of the coin, and they'll say, no, you can't have friends, you know, come into the house, you know. So, you know, that goes along with the territory, too. And that makes it kind of sad for us, I think. You know, it's when you can't even have friends over to your house. Did you go over to their house? Were you able to go over and see people?
Well, yeah, sometimes I'd go over to their house. And I would have people over at my house from time to time because, I don't know, sometimes you have very blatant abuse and then sometimes you have very, like my sister, he was very good at, like, putting on a show when he had to. But then once people got to know him, then they would see what was really, like, below the surface. So, like, there was birthdays and stuff. I might have, like, a friend spend the night. Lots of times I was grounded because I feel like if I even breathed the wrong way, I was considered demon-possessed and I was grounded. Like,
wow.
So I was grounded, like, a lot.
No, that's too bad. They're the ones that needed to be grounded, not you.
Yeah, and I would go to school, and, like, there's kids who are doing, like, so much worse than me, and I'm like, but my, you know, when you're talking about school and stuff, and that's another thing, like, in this role, I've done a lot of research with, like, the ACE studies and resiliency, you know, when I look back, like, why did I get this far, like, what happened, I really think the resiliency for me was I always had some positive role model in my life, and whether it was a teacher, whether it was a, you know, somebody from church, whether it had, you know, like, but there was people who kind of, like, at church, like, I could sing, and so there was, you know, people from church who would kind of showcase that for me. So there was times that, like, I got to feel special by people. There was times people would take me under their wing, you know, and do it just because, you know. So, like, there was always somebody looking out for me. And, you know, there was always somebody who could kind of, you know, see a little bit more to things and just kind of be there as a support, I guess. Without, you know, trash talk. But I actually, like, I had to testify for the guy who raped me because, it's a long story, but pretty much, like, it happened. There were things that happened to somebody else, so they wanted me to come in and testify as to show, like, there was, I guess, like, a pattern, like, this has happened before. So I had to face this man. I was in seventh grade, I'm sorry. And I really connected with my homeroom teacher, like, for some reason. Yeah, like, I really connected with him. And I opened up to him about a lot. And he was a Bible teacher, go figure. But he actually came to the court hearing with me because he knew I was scared because I had to see this man, and he wanted me to be able to look out and see, like, a familiar face. Do you mean, like, a friendly face? You know, so there was people that went above and beyond who, you know, maybe couldn't do things from certain perspectives, but were there, and that was enough.
Yeah, but I call those people, like, angels. I think I had a lot of angels in my life, you know, because there are people, sometimes they're just plain some kind people out there, and they can tell that there's something a little bit wrong, and maybe they won't pressure you or ask you questions or any of that other stuff, but even just a smile or putting their arm around your shoulder and making you feel special in a sense, in a good, positive way, you know, or just, you know, helping you out with this or helping you out with that. A little bit of this and that all throughout your life means it's very, very important. you know. And there are times that there are teachers, say, who can tell that there's something not quite right, you know. And then they might be good teachers. So that does happen, too. So tell me more. Okay, so you broke up with your boyfriend. You had the abortion. You broke up with your boyfriend. What happened after that? Where did you go? What did you do?
Well, actually, when I broke up with him, I was 21, and I actually got out and went to a women's shelter for battered and abused women, and it was actually there that I found out I was pregnant with my third child. So there was the dilemma, what do? Do I go back, you know, because I'm a single mom, I waitress, I, you know, don't make a lot of money, you know, because you learn to depend on, at least I did, him for certain things. And maybe he wasn't there, but at least he was there, I guess, like, if that makes sense. So I ran into, like, that dilemma. And what actually happened is I knew he had warrants out for his arrest. And one time I let him come because he was stalking me and stuff like that. So I actually had him come over and I called the police, you know, and then they arrested him and took him to jail. And I was able to get an emergency PFA and go through the whole nine there. But even with that PFA, you know, he violated it. You know, it took years to get him away. But I mean, it got to a point where it's like I remember rolling up in a ball, and I think about this a lot lately, and I don't know why, but curling up in a ball, crying to God, like, I can't do this, like, either take me or, like, there's no way 10 years ago I could have saw any kind of future for myself.
Well, you've come a long way, so, because now today you're a nurse. When did you become a nurse?
2013 is when I graduated.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, there's a lot of people that that go through enormous amounts of abuse, and they don't really grow, okay? Let me ask you something. Did you ever see a therapist? Did you ever go for help in, you know, in that, with all the things that you've gone through?
Well, I did when I was younger. I was in and out of therapy because our DA's office, anytime somebody's sexually assaulted and goes through the process, they work with a local agency, and they have free counseling, therapy programs, stuff like that. So, like, I was in that program for a while. I really bonded with the one counselor there. And I've been kind of in and out ever since because, I mean, like I said, I'm not a perfect child. Like, I had my issues, too. Like, I would, you know, cut. I would, you know, like, there's, I was bulimic. Like, there was things that, you know, I was battling too, you know. So I did see counselors on and off. I really didn't talk much though when I was younger because it was one of those things where I knew if I talk and it got back, things would be worse for me. So, you know, and every time we'd go in, they would fill the counselors or the therapist with how I'm a horrible person and all this stuff. So I'm not going to open up to somebody who now has this notion, you know. So it's just weird, but I did actually start seeing a therapist about 3 years ago because with my job now, you know, obviously that can get triggering, and I needed some kind of professional outlet, you know, that I could take to. So I actually am in therapy now.
That's good. But let me say something to you. First of all, you're not a terrible person. You're not, okay? Listen here. All of us, even in the best of circumstances, kids from, I call them normie homes, regular homes, make mistakes. That's number one. Number two, people like us who come from homes that are terribly dysfunctional, we make bad choices and we make mistakes too. And it was never, ever, ever, ever our fault. You have to understand that. All right? We didn't ask to be born, and we didn't ask to go through the type of life that we went through. None of us. And these things happen to kids, unfortunately. We know the stats, and you certainly probably know them too. One out of four girls and one out of six boys will be sexually abused by the time they're 18. And the stats are even higher for those children who come from dysfunctional homes where there's a lot of beatings going on, say, again, father with mother, mother being beaten, that many times 70%, at least 70, and now they're saying 75% to 80% of those children turn into victims as well, where they're hit, okay? And they, if they don't get help for that, a lot of times they become abusers themselves, okay, where they abuse their family, you know, with physical abuse. As far as the sexual abuse, no, there's not that many of us that turn into abusers. Actually, the stats are not that high. Most of us know what it's like to be, you know, we know what it's like to be sexually abused and to go through all that trauma and all of that terrible, the feelings that we have of self-worth, and, you know, no self-worth and all the feelings of, that we go through. We don't want to pass that on to other children, okay?
Right.
And when we don't have that in us anyway, I mean, either you are a pedophile or you're not a pedophile. Either you are a sex offender or you're not a sex offender, okay? And so often we turn to the type of work where we end up working with people, okay, to try and help. This is what we do, so many of us. And look at what you're doing right now. Why don't you start telling us a little bit about your nursing career? I'd like to hear it. I know everybody would. Go ahead.
So I'm a registered nurse, first and foremost, but I'm in the forensic sexual, I'm a forensic examiner, sexual assault examiner, forensic examiner. So our patients, we work with patients who are the victims of, like, acute domestic violence. So we get a lot of child abuse, elder abuse, domestic, and then we also see patients who have been sexually assaulted and raped. And there's, like, a lot of – it's all patient-dependent on, you know, because everybody's at different places. They require different needs. They want to do – so it's really, you know, telling them, okay, here's where we're at. Here's your options. And because they always have options, and that's always what I like to stress to people, you know, like, you always have options, you know, and sometimes the people are like, I'll ask, okay, what at here and now, like, what would you like to see happen in the situation if you could have any possibility in the world? And sometimes we just kind of have to take it from there, you know. But yeah, I knew when I was in placement, that because there was some counselors that you just kind of, like, you looked forward when they came to work, like, you got all excited, and there was people who you opened up to. And for me, I could always tell somebody who had some kind of history, whether they would tell me or it was just a feeling I got, but they just treated me different and they heard me different. And I knew I wanted to get into the field of child abuse somehow. Yeah, I didn't know how, you know, and then of course, as I get older, you know, got in a bad relationship, I was really just surviving. And like the opportunity kind of presented itself, so I took it to go back to school for nursing. I can't say, like, I wanted to be a nurse all my life. Not that I don't care about people. I just, my thing was just survival mode. So I wasn't thinking long-term goals.
Right.
Then when I found out about this field, it was just instantaneous. There was a nurse who, you know, was doing this work, and she was telling me about it. And as soon as she was telling me, I was like, that's the job for me. Like, I have to do this job. Like, this is what I'm here for, you know, like, at the time. So, and then I pursued this role.
Well, you see, that that's very common, you know. And I'm glad that you're doing it. And you should be proud of yourself, okay? Be proud of yourself. Because you're doing very, very good work. You're working with the system. You're helping other people. You're going into the courtrooms. You're doing all the things, you know, that that so many times, you know, people need. They need someone who understands because they've been there, okay? And we all on this panel, the whole bunch of us, we've all been there. So we can easily minister, and we seem, it's like we have antennas too, you know, like we can tell by looking at a child many times that they're in an abusive situation, even if we don't see bruises or anything, because a lot of times they're covered up, aren't they, with clothing. We know this. You know, they have ways of hiding it, things, and they don't make eye contact. Or maybe they're terribly neglected too, and they won't, maybe they're kind of dirty looking and not cared for. So we see these things, and we know There's just something inside of us that we know that something's not right. And we're actually more helpful to children like that than people who have just book knowledge. It's good to have both. Yes, absolutely. But when we've been to it, when we've walked that walk and have book knowledge, whoa, we're dynamite, okay? We can really help people. Let me go back to the panel now, and then we'll get back to your nursing and what you do exactly in court. That would be quite interesting.
Sure.
I'll start with Joe right now. Okay, Joe, is there something that you wanted to ask or make a comment about?
Yes. I wanted to find out how your therapy is going. Is it are you finding out things that sort of help you along the way? And if, for example, if something is triggering you at work, are you able to talk with your therapist about it to try to talk through that so it's not staying with you? Do you have that kind of trust with the therapist?
That's actually a good question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I've actually realized a lot about myself for the past 2 years that, like, I never even dreamed with, you know, and I realized that really all I've been doing is surviving, and I realized, you know, like, there's a lot of, like you were saying, anger and, you know, resentment that happens, which I had, but I would always run away from this feeling. So if there was a certain person who would, like, trigger me, or I knew I didn't like them, I couldn't put my finger on why, I couldn't, you know, and I would feel like a horrible person, but I would just stay away from them, like no harm, no foul, you know what I mean, stay away from them, forget everything, whatever. And I started, you know, when I started going to therapy and working through these issues, I'm realizing that what I was really doing, it wasn't the fact that I didn't like these people, it was, you know, resentment of things that, like, I never got as a child that I desperately wanted. It wasn't so much them, it was me. But pretty much what I was doing all along was really just avoiding those feelings. So, you know, in therapy, like, it's really going through getting rid of all those trauma-induced surviving mechanisms. And I have so many that I didn't even realize, like, I had. But it's nice to have that objective person to be able to throw back, you know, to, you know, put me in check sometimes, like, okay, you know, question my thinking, because there's times, like, I know, you know, because you get down to the biology of it and how it reprograms your brain, and yeah, all that makes sense to me now. And that's why, like, I really dove into, like, this subject, because I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, it just explains so much. And before, like, I always thought I was so weird and so different, so I would stay away from people because I knew I wasn't quite like them. And it showed, and I just always felt out of place. So as I'm, like, learning more about the brain, and, like, this really is, there's a science to it, and it's really a thing, like, I didn't feel quite as abnormal, you know, like, okay, well, maybe I am a little different, but this is why I'm different. It makes sense.
Very cool.
Yeah, therapy has really been able to help a lot. Now, I did just get a new therapist, so... because my old therapist went to, like, a different practice in another state or whatever. So I've kind of – I went a little backwards as far as, like, the trust issues, because it takes a lot of that trust.
Oh, it does. It does, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's good, though. That you keep going, though. That's cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Joe. And let's go down to Miss Tennessee. And are you there? Darlene.
Hello. I'm sorry. I had to get my food out of the oven right quick.
Okay. Do you have a question you want to ask or a comment you want to make?
I want to say it's very brave of her doing this, telling her story, and it is very hard, too, you know, whenever you go through therapy. And, like, I had to start all over with a new therapist recently, as y'all all know. And it is always tough when you go to a new therapist as well, because you always have that fear of whether or not they're going to believe you or not believe you, or whether you're going to have to fire that one and get another one, you know. It's always that fear, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be all right. You know, that's what you got to understand. It will all be all right.
Thank you.
That's right. And thank you for that, Darlene. Enjoy your meal, honey. I'm hungry too. Okay. Let's go down to William. William, are you there?
And she's working in some of the area I'm familiar with because I'm a legal assistant. So I know what she's talking about, that because of that, things in the courts too, which she hasn't elaborated on, but I'm familiar with what she's doing as a nurse and the things involved with some of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister's also a nurse. That's
oh,
the point.
Okay.
But I've studied forensic sciences and things in my courses and stuff like that because I'm more law oriented and stuff like that with the things that I get into.
Right.
I'm glad. I know you probably have a difficult time dealing with some of that, but maybe you've overcome a lot of that.
I'm still working on some of it.
Yeah. Because some of those people, when they come in, they're in bad shape or they're traumatic shape and things like that. And that may be hard for you to deal with, but you're dealing with it as a nurse and a professional basis. So that helps when you have the stability there.
Right.
If you know what
I
mean.
And that's actually what I love about my job, is I don't have to get caught up in the investigation. I don't have to get caught up in the politics of it all. Like, I can just treat my patient, because I always say, like, first and foremost, like, I'm a nurse. I'm here to, you know, help advocate physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, like, wherever my patient's at, like, I'm here for them, like, to give them options and to make them human. Because I feel like anytime you go through something so traumatic, you become less and less human. Like, you separate yourself, you know, so just making somebody seen, heard, and just be a human being. That's my priority, like, to give them options. Like, okay, here's where we're at. Here's what could happen, you know, and let them make the decisions on what they want me to do for them. I know a lot about the legal process because I have to, obviously. I can go and I can testify, but it's really like being able to explain that to the patient. So, because everybody's at different spots, you know, some people, you know, yes, I want to pressure. Some people just aren't ready, and that's okay too. But it's meeting that person where they're at. How can I help you to do what's in your best interest? Because nobody knows what's in somebody's best interest except them. You know, I don't know where they're at, what they have to go home to, what their circumstances are, you know, what their fears are. Things like that. So.
Well, I'm glad she's doing such a good job.
Yeah, it sounds like she really is, and that's so good. Everything that you just said there is quite a mouthful, because there are so many things. You're dealing with people who you know, have been fractured, you know, spiritually, mentally, physically, emotionally. And let me ask you something. Are you taking in children? Do you work with children, or are you working with adults, or does it matter not, or what?
Both, yeah, we do. We see a lot of child abuse. We see elder abuse. I mean, we get patients of all ages.
Mary
Ellen is also on the panel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm sorry, Mary Ellen. go ahead. You have a question or comment you want to make. Go ahead.
You don't have to apologize.
I can't see. I don't have the studio in front of me. So go ahead.
I was just thinking, as Michelle's been talking about, I guess I want to refer to it as cycles that I've gone through in my life, where I've gotten to points where I thought, I've handled this, I'm doing well, I'm moving forward. And then there'll be a trigger, and then you handle it and you do well and you grow from that spot. And it's kind of like a progression, like she said. And it kind of always surprises me at what a surprise it is when a trigger occurs and sets you back, you know, because it usually is going to catch you right off guard. And I guess hanging on to the fact that all the progress you've made and the accomplishments you've been able to help people through so much, that no matter where you end up, just remember it's just another step, and everything you've done just goes to show how strong you really are.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you. She makes a lot of good points there. See, everybody's different in their healing journey, you know. Everyone's at a different level. And there are things that are going to, you know, trigger us no matter, I don't care how old you are, okay, or how young you are. You can get triggered throughout your life at times. But I can say honestly that as time goes by, like if I have a nightmare, okay, I just sit up, I get mad, and I say, I roll over and go back to sleep. I'm able to do that, okay? At one time, I would get up and I'd go through maybe a pack of cigarettes or something when I was still smoking, you know, because I didn't know how to handle, you know, the nightmare. And, you know, there's so many things that we have, like I said earlier, that we have to, you know, work through with ourselves, whether it be nightmares, flashbacks, suicidal ideations, which I used to go through also, and all different types of things that we had to deal with. And you're quite right. With the ACE study, we study that, and we speak about that on the show. You know, like everyone's at a different level. It's I believe it's 10. I'm number 9, so I'm right up there. And, you know, one thing they have found out with children who have been, you know, abused, our brains are different. But that doesn't make us lesser than, okay? I was picking up something when you were saying that before. We're not lesser than. What happens is the other brain cells come running in like little maniacs to the areas of our brain, that whether it be like with like a lot of times we'll forget things, okay, or our mind won't let us remember things. It's like repressed memories, okay. We dissociate. Well, all kinds of things might happen. We could be quite fragmented, and our brain actually tries to go to its aid, okay. Like when you, you're a nurse, you know this. If you sprain your ankle, what happens? Your ankle swells up. And that water, you know, fills in that area in our brain. What happens is other cells run over to the areas that have been damaged, okay? And it doesn't make us lesser than or maybe not quite as smart or anything. For God's sake, look at you. What are you? You're a forensic nurse, you know, so you're not dumb.
Yeah, that's one thing that's so interesting. Like that whole, like, emotional the emotional flashbacks and stuff. And I did so much research on this because, like I said, I just dove into it because I was like, oh, my God, it was like this eye awakening, like, experience. And I'm like, this is me. And, you know, how, you know, your brain literally rewires itself for survival. Mm-hmm. So your emotional brain and your logical brain are no longer connecting, you know, because you've had to live emotionally for so long. And I, you know, it's those emotional flashbacks when it's like, but I don't know why, you know, and you have to then you process, you know, but I would like have highs and lows, and I could never, I just thought that was how I was, you know, like that's how God made me, whatever. And I hated it. So I would always avoid certain things, but I never realized like, no, like that's literally how my brain adapted to survive. Now I have to work on rewiring it so I can make things logical again. You know, but it's, you know, how you can go back and experience things in the past that you don't even realize that you're reliving because your emotional brain and your logical brain just isn't connecting those dots.
Right.
It's wild.
Well, everything falls in place at times and in its own time, I should say. And then there are some things that we're not going to quite remember. Okay.
Right.
And that's okay. All right. What we're doing is we're people who have been injured, okay, and there's no doubt about that. But we're still standing. I like to put it that way. We're still standing. We are survivors. We're survivors. And so many of us do have our different talents, you know. Some people are songwriters. I wrote a book, and I love to sing, too, and my voice is not so, I'm on the phone all the time. I have a frog in my voice. But the point is that we have our talents. We you know, we're just as good than anyone else. In fact, I look at it as we being better because we went through so much and we're still standing and we're able to help other people, okay? So during your healing journey, you're going to have days where you go backwards a few steps and then you're going to go forward, you know, maybe 4 or 5 steps. You see, that's all a part of the healing journey. I don't know if you have nightmares. I don't know if you have Other disorders, what do you have? What do you have?
As far as like diagnoses?
Mm-hmm.
Or I do get nightmares. I actually, my doctor just prescribed me medicine to help with them, and that was like after COVID, mm-hmm. but before all the riots and everything broke out. So like I kind of joke because I'm like, okay, like I just got put on medicine to help with my PTSD nightmares, but it's not really like nightmares anymore because it's going on everywhere in the world around me. So
you bet. You bet.
You know, I joke about it. You know, it's not funny, but I mean, there is truth to it.
Sure, there is.
I have complex post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
I know I'm on propranolol for the PTSD response for that flight or flight because I will go into my body just naturally reacts with it. And literally, like, I become, like, my neck will get all splotchy. Like, I literally have physical manifestations when I go into flight or flight. Over
mm-hmm.
some little things that, like, I can't even hide it even if I wanted to.
Propranolol,
that's a blood pressure medicine, you know, but it also helps with that fight or flight response to kind of get you out of survival mode to reality, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're probably very hypervigilant, too. This is all about the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder, okay? This is what people go mm-hmm. through. You know, who have been abused and come from such terrible backgrounds where, you know, everything is so dysfunctional. Many times, you know, we go through all of these different things. We all of a sudden, I had terrible panic, like, for instance, terrible panic attacks. And so I wrote a book called Panic Child because I was having all these panic attacks, and damn it, I was mad, and I wanted people to know about it, okay? So, you know, that's just the type of person I am. But anyway, but we go through all of these things. We go through all of these things, and it's very normal for us to go through those things. And it's sometimes we do take meds. You know, meds are very beneficial to a lot of people. Other times people don't need meds. They get mad like I do and say, and roll over and go back to sleep. It took me a while to get there, though. Okay. So all these things that you're going through, you know, is very common to those of us who have been abused. And like I said before, you're in the right place. I hope that after this night is over that you come back as a panelist. And we could certainly use a nurse on the panel, you know, because, you know, you're in a place where people understand, and we are trying to make people even more aware. Child abuse is now more spoken about than it was before, okay? When I wrote my book, the people didn't want to talk about child abuse. Trust me. A lot of times they still don't want to speak about it, but it is out there. And by coming on shows like NASCA, okay, the Stop Child Abuse Now show, you're telling your story. You are a family member now because you have told your story. You're telling it, and we're going to get right back to it. But you're helping many people because many people will listen, you know, to this show. If they're not on it now, they're listening later. And you'll be teaching people by what you're saying, and they see that they're not alone, and that's what's so important. They're not alone.
Right.
Okay, so what you were saying before, getting back to your nursing and what you do in court and all of this, tell us a little bit more about that. Say you have a 10-year-old child, male or female, it doesn't matter which. What do you do for this child when you go in? What do you do in the court system?
In the court system? Well, we only get involved if we get subpoenaed. Obviously, there's mandated child abuse reporting laws and everything. So, you know, children and youth will reach out to us, and, you know, we will give our opinion based on, you know, from medically what I'm seeing, you know, as opposed to what they're saying. You know what I mean? It's just kind of filling in, like, the medical aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the the DA, you know, if it goes to court and the DA would like us to give like our medical knowledge to the jury, we will go in and we'll help educate the jury just from like a medical standpoint. You know, this is what I saw, this is what I'm seeing, this is, you know, what could cause it. Because sometimes there's, you know, more than one cause, and it's really
mm-hmm.
just giving them the proper information so they can make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the police might have questions about like, could this happen? You know what I mean? So that way they know how to charge. And it's just giving that objective feedback from like a medical perspective. What is pathophysiology? Like, what's going on here from like a medical perspective, and how is that contributing to what you're seeing?
Right.
Or what the child's saying, or, you know what I mean? Like, just kind of given
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
We can get sworn in as, like, an expert. So mm-hmm. I know the one gentleman said he's familiar with the court system, but you have fact witnesses and then you have expert witnesses. So a fact witness, you just say, you know, the facts of the situation. So, you, like, if you're a police officer, yes, I got called to this address. Yes, this is what I saw. This is what, you know, it's just facts. When you're an expert, you give the facts, you give what you saw, but you can also give an opinion. Like, they'll ask your opinion. Like, okay, so in your expert opinion, in your experience, in your training,
mm-hmm.
what are your thoughts? So we can do that then as well. And obviously explain why we feel that way.
Right. And that's very, very important, especially for the case. Do you also deal with rape kits, like, you know, if an 18-year-old or 16-year-old or someone is raped?
Mm-hmm.
Do you deal with that aspect of it? And that's brought forth then, too, in the court, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good.
Yep. You have to, you know, keep up with the chain of custody and things like that. But, yeah, we'll do that. Now, there's very specific time windows. So, you know, assuming they're within that time frame that we can collect evidence and assuming that's what the patient wants me to do, because, you know, some patients just want to know they're okay, get resources, and that's okay, too, you know, but it's really
mm-hmm.
just explaining their options. Like, okay, based on what you're telling me, based on these time frames, this is what I can do for you. Now,
mm-hmm.
what do you want me to do for you? You know what I mean? So, but
right.
that is a direction we can go if that's how the patient wants to proceed.
Well, okay, let me ask you something. Say 3 years ago someone got raped, okay, so they're 15, a 15-year-old girl gets raped, okay, and
mm-hmm.
they do a rape kit on her, but maybe it doesn't go to court for a year or a year and a half because they're backlogged. What does that do to the rape kit? Is that still effective? I mean, is it still good? Can it be used, or does it change? What happens to the rape kit? Does it get old? I don't know how else to
board
this.
Well, we don't keep it here. Like, we'll collect it and we'll package it up. You know, we'll keep the chain of custody. So pretty much, you know, maintaining that accountability that this was in my possession at all times. It's not tampered with. It's, you know, I can
mm-hmm.
testify to how I collected it if there's questions, you know, things of that nature. And then we pass it off to whatever investigating law enforcement. And then it becomes part of their investigation. So what happens to it after that
mm-hmm.
would be through whatever police, whatever their protocols were, are for that specific police department.
Right.
So, I get, you know, things like that where I'm not quite sure, like, I'll explain, like, what I know, and I'll tell them, like, you might want to reach out to whatever detective is handling this case because, you know, that's a good question, you know, that you might want to ask them because they'll be more familiar with that from their point of view. You know what I mean? What happens
yes.
from there, so.
Yes, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. So tell us what your how are you married today, or do you have a child? I think you said you had how many children do you have? Do you have children?
Yeah, I actually have 5 children. And
wow.
I'm married.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because, like, there was a point in time I was devastated because I was told there's a large possibility that, like, I probably won't be able to have kids. But just the fact that, like, I have one kid is, like, a miracle. But I have 5 healthy kids, so, yeah.
Well, that's wonderful.
And they're,
that's
I'd say
wonderful.
My youngest is 11, and then my oldest is 18, so we've got a range.
Well, that's great because, you know, what you were saying before, I was afraid maybe that you couldn't have children, you know, so that's really good. That's good to know. And you're happy today, correct? You have a good marriage?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And
yeah, that's
it's
good.
Funny because everybody brings things into the relationship, but I have to say, like, my husband, like, he's been on this journey with me, too, and it's a culture shock for him. Because he's grown
mm-hmm.
up a totally separate, like, his parents are still together, you know, good Catholic family. It's just totally different. Like, it was a total culture shock when he met me. And I know,
mm-hmm.
like, there's things, like, with my family, with my life, like, he'll get very upset about, like the narcissistic families, you know what I mean? Like, the favoritism, the, you know,
yeah.
stuff like that. Like,
mm-hmm.
sometimes I think I'm so used to it that he gets more upset than I do.
Right.
And his parents
right.
get upset over it. And I'm just like, like, this is how it is. Like, so it is, it's a culture shock for him, but he's been really great in trying to understand and be there the best way he can.
Well, I am so happy. You know, it's so nice to have someone on who found a good spouse, you know, to put it that way, so that they're happy and they have a really, really good marriage. You know, that's just wonderful. I want to go around the panel again really quick. Yeah, I think I'm so happy for you. I really am. You're a success case. That's what you are, by guy. Okay, let's go around the panel one more time so people can thank you for being on, and they probably might have maybe a quick question. I'll go to Joe first, and I'll go down the line. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for being here, Michelle. There's only about 8.5 minutes, so I'm going to pass it along to the next one. Thank
Go
you,
ahead.
Dee, for being here. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good. Okay, thank you. Okay. Go ahead. Okay, Tennessee, Darlene.
Hello. that takes a lot of – I'm glad you got a good spouse, and I'm glad that the family's supportive to you as well.
Mm-hmm.
And kudos to you being a nurse, and you have a PTSD and working in that field as well.
Yeah.
I know it's probably, you know, when people might, like you said, might give you the PTSD type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've got PTSD as well. And the doctor was wanting me to try that new medication. But he did not realize that I've already got a problem with my blood pressure where it stays kind of low, okay? So I couldn't take that medication because it'll make it too low. So it's like, if he has, you know what I mean?
It's that balancing act, yeah.
Yeah, it's that balance. But, I admire you a lot for the fortitude. I had taken, I got a degree in medical coding and billing, so I know a lot of what you're dealing with, too, on top of not just the what you're going through as a survivor, but also as the medical part. So,
thank you.
Well, thank you for that, Darlene. And Mary Ellen,
Fell out one smart cookie.
Yes, you are. You both are. Okay.
Oh, thank you.
yes, she is. Okay. Mary Ellen, is there something you'd like to add to that or to ask a question?
I'd just like to say that I've really enjoyed all your positive attitude and your experiences that you've shared. You've done a great job expressing all of it.
Thank you.
Everyone's story is different and unique, even though we have similar issues. Everybody owns their own story, and you've done a great job with it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for that, Mary Ellen. That's very good. And William, is there something that you wanted to add to, or you a quick question?
Well, I knew what she was talking about, transfer of evidence and things like that, because then between the police department, the judicial branch, and a lot of things like that, as well as the prosecutor, because I'm in that other end of things where she's on the opposite end, but she's also testifying as scientific evidence and things, and what makes her like an expert witness is what they consider her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I'm glad she's doing what she's doing and she's telling her story, and that's a good thing.
Thank you.
Keep it up.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that, William. Thank you so much. Well, you see, now that wasn't terribly painful, was it?
No.
No. No. And you did a fine job. You absolutely did. The show is almost over. I think we have about 4 minutes, maybe 3 minutes. But what would you like to leave with the people that you know, have been listening tonight? What type of advice would you give them? What for hope?
The hope. I don't know. It gets better. Like there is always hope. I know. I just remember there being times when I would literally cry to God, like, just end it now. Like, I don't want to be here. I did after this, you know, but there's always a reason. And there is a lot of beauty. I mean, people don't like to talk about child abuse, but the fact that, like, we are more connected with the world and our emotions and, you know, able to express ourselves differently, but beautifully. Like, most artists and musicians and stuff, you know, they do work more out of their emotional brain. And I think that is a beauty that kind of comes with the ugliness of abuse. You know what I mean? Like, we're able to express ourselves in more creative, positive ways, I think.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. That's exactly right. We've been many times I'm asked to do presentations. A lot of us do that also because it's amazing. It's amazing how many doctors don't know enough about child abuse, okay, and the ramifications of what can do to a child. They might have the what's in the books, but they don't understand the emotional, like you were just speaking about, how it brings you down and the things that, you know, how it really clenches your heart, how it makes you feel like nothing, and the low self-esteem, all these things that we have to go through. And it is all a process. It really is a process. Of healing. And let me tell you something, people out there, if you have gone through, you know, abuse of this nature, don't feel funny about going and getting help. So often people just say, especially with guys, right? They say, I have to be macho. I don't want people to know about that. I've had men call me at 2-3 o'clock in the morning and ask me questions and so forth, which I'm thankful for, but everyone can use some help when you've been through this, because this was a battle too. This was a battle too, you bet. And I just want people to know that NASCA does have a contact page, and on that contact page there's many different names of people that you can call day or night. Okay, I'm the night owl. Michelle Bless also, who was on yesterday, she too is a night owl. And I stay up until 2-3 o'clock in the morning. I've had some jobs where I did the AM. That's why I'm used to that. And you being a nurse, you know what I'm talking about. So, yeah. So, you know, you can call us at any time, and we can help you. We're here for you, okay? NASCA is a place where you can come to tell your story, and also you can do a couple times during the week. We have other experts that come on, and they tell their stories, and also are there for Q&A, okay, in case you have questions you want to ask them. So we're on 5 days a week, and I just want to thank, you know, Michelle so much for being a part of this. You are a family member now. You know how to call the show, okay? And so anytime you want to come on, Monday through Friday, same time for you, you know, just give us a call and you can be part of the panel. And if you go on to www.nasca.org, NASCA.org. It shows you Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, who's going to be on. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we have our special guests on, and that's what you were tonight, a special guest. And now, how do you feel? Don't you feel so much more calm?
Yeah, I do feel better. Thank you.
Yeah, I can tell. We can all tell it in your voice. Now you're fine, okay? You're much better. You're just, you know, in a different realm now. Everything's fine. And you did a great thing tonight. You shared your story. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, you did a fine job, too. Now, Joe, how much time do we have left?
About a little over a minute.
About a minute. A little over a minute. Okay, so I'm going to do something that Charlie does, okay? I want everyone on the panel, I want all of us, at the count of three, what's the matter? I want you to say, I want you to say, good night and thank you, okay? 1, 2, 3, good night and thank you.
Good night,
thank you. Good job, all right. And you come back and see us again, all right?
All right, thank you so much.
You're welcome, honey. Thank you so much. You can play the music now, Joe.
Thanks.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.